Great. So I'm Rick Hansen, and it's April 12, 2017. And as you probably know, we've been exploring relationships this year. And today I want to talk about one of the central tensions or apparent paradoxes or balances, or maybe to put it a little differently, the sweet spot we're looking for that balances, on the one hand, a teaching tradition in Buddhism that says cling less, with the other side of the equation being that that teaching tradition also says love more. So how do we balance those two? Cling less, less attached, less craving, less fixation on results, while on the other hand, opening our heart wider and wider, cultivating compassion, cultivating loving kindness, cultivating a commitment to justice, benevolence for other beings. How do we balance those two, where the rubber really meets the road? It's a really central question, including for somebody like me who has a background in developmental psychology with its strong emphasis on attachment theory and the importance of secure attachment. And also as a longtime rock climber, getting a little older, so not so much, but you know, boom, I know what it's like to cling to that rock in a way that's really good. So how do we balance that, right? And you could imagine this as well in the sphere of passion or ambition or creative expression or self-expression. How do we dream big dreams, dare greatly, as Brené Brown puts it, without getting hooked on the outcomes and, you know, the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, et cetera? Fundamental question, right? And to kind of enter it, I want to offer a quotation, apparently from the Buddha. It's come down to us from 2,500 or so years ago. And the sentence or so I'd like to offer to you is this comment that the wise one, freed from longing through insight, is as untroubled as a mountain pond. So it's very helpful to, I think, unpack these words and to think of them as a way of describing a very wakeful, awakening consciousness. Wise one, freed from longing. Something problematic in longing. What is longing? Freed from longing through insight is as untroubled as a mountain pond. Really beautiful. So how do we find that? I think there's probably something in us that resonates. I could see something of that in the room that resonates with the truth of that. And on the other hand, how do we balance that with our desire to have a partner or our fierce protection of our children or other beings, including non-human beings? How do we put those two together? And I'd like to enter that topic with a story about myself when I didn't put them together very well. So it's like the saying in medicine, good judgment comes from experience, and experience comes from bad judgment. So this was an experience I had. I'll soften some of the edges of some of the details to protect the guilty. But our son, Forrest, was about 8 or 9 years old, and he was just entering the Boy Scouts. And I'd been a Boy Scout myself for a little bit. We had kind of a juvenile delinquent troop, which was good for me because I was such a goody two-shoes, dorky, shy, nerdy guy. So it was a good balance for me. But anyway, but for Forrest, his troop was well-run, well-managed, really exemplary leadership in it. And you know, I certainly want to, in my account here, you know, give them full respect, well-deserved, full gratitude. So there was what's called a Pinewood Derby. I don't know if you have any background here. These little cars made of wood with wheels that are put on a inclined plane that are, I don't know, 50 feet or so long, and they race them side by side, and the boys and the Boy Scouts paint their little cars and make them, and then they compete to see who wins the Pinewood Derby, okay? And I'm not the handiest guy in the world, so it was a real process for Forrest and me to build his car together. It's kind of a parent-child thing. And, you know, he painted it, and he was really happy about it. And Forrest was then and a really sweet, open-hearted, intelligent, slightly physically uncoordinated kid, who eventually became very coordinated. He's now a very skillful swing dancer and ballroom dancer and teacher of dance. And if you look at him, dude is buff. But that's 29. This is now 8 years old, but however many years ago that it was. So 21 years ago. So anyway, so there's the Pinewood Derby. So we do the Pinewood Derby. So far, so good, right? Not a lot of attachment, not a lot of alarm bells, not a lot of fixation on the results. That was to come. So the Pinewood Derby happens, and Forrest, who'd never won anything competitively, his car was winning. And I was out of my mind. I was so happy for him. I was like, oh, great, you know, sympathetic joy, you know, mudita, happiness for the happiness and good fortune of others and so forth. It was great. So far, so good, right? And my wife and our young daughter were there as well, if I recall correctly. And it was all very exciting. And then they tallied up the results. And I could watch this other car kind of maybe doing a little better than Forrest's car, but I was counting. And his was winning most of the head-to-head heats. So, like, what's up here? And we were like, oh, my goodness. And I so wanted him to be celebrated, you know, as a winner. So far, so good. But you can start to see the yellow flags beginning to accumulate. All right? And then the results were announced. Johnny's a winner. Bobby's a winner. I'm like, third place, please, third place. And Frankie's a winner, not Forrest. And I'm thinking, Frankie, or whatever the kid's name was. And no disrespect or ill will toward Frankie, but my son's car beat your car, you know? So what's up? So I'm like kind of startled and freaked out, and Forrest is crestfallen. You know, I really feel it, you know, compassion. I feel it. I want him to win, you know, or just be, have some standing, right? And so we go away, and I make a choice. So far, so good, but I'm edging farther and farther out onto thinner and thinner ice. I make a choice to send an email to the scoutmaster. What happened? Help me explain this, right? And then he sends me an email back that says, oh, no, we really counted it fairly. It just, you know, it's true. I felt the brush off. Ooh, I don't like that. So I went, wait a minute. And in my polite, I'm a psychologist, but I would have been a good lawyer. I'm very glad I didn't go down that road because it would have probably brought out some of my worst tendencies. But anyway, I wrote him back a polite, civil email saying, you know, explain to me how this happened, because I was there and I counted and I watched it. And he says, oh, don't worry. Again, this is how we do it. And we just sort of randomly throw out some of the results because it makes it easier to score. Oh, baby. A, you screwed my kid. B, you did it unfairly. What up? So, oh, man, I'm mobilized now. Okay, so it's in the service of a good aim, you know, wholesome aim. Right? So you think about the big three. What's your intent? Is it a wholesome, as you judge ultimately, but is it a wholesome aim pursued through wholesome means without attachment to the results? Attachment in the problematic sense. Okay, so I had a wholesome end. Justice, sticking up for my kid, wanting him to have a good one. I'm starting to tip though into problematic means because my inner prosecutor is getting organized. I'm right. They're wrong. I'm logical. So I send him another email. It's very civil, but it's, you know, like these people walking down the street. They're talking with each other, but you see the thought balloon over their head. You know, the thought balloon, or you sort of leak something. You know, my email might as well have had a, like, big red light flashing out of it. The underlying subtext, two words, you idiot. You know, so not so good, right? So this lands, and then, of course, a certain amount of storm and trouble starts spinning out. A certain defensiveness comes the other way. You can understand the scoutmaster is thinking, why in the world am I dealing with this maniac? You know, me. You know, like, do I really sign up for this? trying to explain what had happened. It was an innocent intent. There was no malintent. It wasn't very skillful. You know, it wasn't, in a sense, fundamentally fair. And at the end of the day, it's just a Pinewood Derby. So we went back and forth, and I finally satisfied myself, in a sense, that the fix was in. There was nothing we could do. I explained to Forrest what had happened, you know, that his card actually really won. But so be it. It was the system. And I could see after a couple of cycles that it really wasn't worth going back and forth any longer. There was no cheese down this tunnel, right? We were outnumbered. It wasn't going to happen. It wasn't like, you know, some benevolent agent, you know, authority figure in the sky was going to swoop down. The uber scoutmaster in the sky wasn't going to reach down and make it all right. And we needed to move on. All right. But what happened then, I noticed, so that was awkward and strange, and I tried to patch it up. But the next time we did an event with the scout troop, I could feel the vibes. You know, the people who were the scoutmaster's friends and the friends of the scoutmaster's wife, who'd gotten involved as well, protecting her husband from my, you know, not so much attack, but just strong case. I was making a very strong case, right? Got involved, and I could just feel that this had become fairly awkward. And we stayed involved, I think maybe another year or so, but clearly something had happened, and we kind of drifted out of that environment. So that's what happened, right? And if you step back and reflect on it, as I have, what do you see? What I see is that I got caught, as the Buddha points out in his kind of umbrella term word, I got caught by craving. I got caught around a kind of drivenness or insistence or tension or rightness or selfing, broadly defined to craving. The root of the word for it in the language of early Buddhism, tanha, is thirst. Something was missing. Justice was missing. The experience I wanted for my son was missing. Logic was missing. Fair play, a level playing field, was missing. Social support and inclusion was missing. Those things, you know, were missing. Thirst, broadly defined. And I tipped into the red zone, tipped into craving. Wasn't horrible. I didn't key the scoutmaster's car. I didn't pour sugar into his gas tank. I've had clients who've done things like that. I didn't totally lose it, you know. And I lost it. I went too far. I was well-intended. What's the road to hell paved with good intentions? My wife says the road to health is paved with good intestines, but that's another story. Anyway, and right there, there's so much teaching. You know, you may have had similar versions of it. You know, rarely do we start out with massively evil intent, and we just want to harm and hurt other people. Usually we start out with good intentions, and then somehow we get caught. We get caught along the way. So how do we learn from experiences like that? And how do we find that place that we're searching for? While we preserve what's wholesome. You know, we stick up for our kids. We have compassion for other people's suffering. We stick up for our own needs. We claim what I call healthy entitlement in our own family, let's say, or in our own work environment to fair treatment. We want to, you know, stand up for ourselves and stand up for other people. How do we balance that without getting sucked into the dark side of the force, as I did? So I want to offer three kind of suggestions and then see what you think about it. Okay, so far? I'm assuming you can kind of relate to my story. You know, like there are aspects of it. Okay, great. So one is to watch that movement from the language of early Buddhism is called chanda, wholesome desire, right? We wish for justice. We want a cookie, let's say. We want our turn when we come to the four-way stop sign. We want people to respond to us politely and not in a mean way. And we want our contributions recognized, whatever it is. We start We want to start a business. We have a wholesome desire. Watch the movement with increasing real-time mindfulness into craving, broadly defined. And there's some clues, I think. And as we meditate here, we get better and better at staying in real-time self-awareness. Or we catch ourselves more rapidly. Maybe we tip, but within a minute or so, we start to notice something's happening, like a fire is brewing in our minds. It's heating up. Or maybe it's an hour later, or we rewind that quarrel we had with someone, and we go, okay, I can observe. I started out green, chartreuse, yellow, orange, red, right? And then what was that trajectory in that whole process? So watching that movement, and some clues. One is tension in the body, great clue. Or a sense of pressure. Pressure is a wonderful word for, as a flashing indicator, tanha alert, craving alert, trouble lies ahead. Sense of pressure, okay? Actually, I want to say something kind of as a quick sidebar. I nearly drowned one time. I've nearly fallen off of rocks to my death. I've been in situations where it looked like our apartment building was about to burn down and we needed to deal with it, you know, like you probably. There are certain situations where, in my personal opinion, it's okay to get into craving. It's okay to be in the red zone, much as other animals are designed to go into full-on craving, fighting for their lives, escaping, or full-on, you know, predatory pursuit of the meal they need for themselves or their children. Okay, I think that's okay to kind of call out that and be aware of the costs and get out of the red zone as fast as you can. And also keep considering, could I pursue the same aim? Protect for the same safety, let's say? Could I avert the same harm without going to war with reality? Okay? So, back to indicators, my first of three main points here. Tension, pressure, also a sense of insistence, mustness. You know, it must. Or its close cousin, should. That was really running. Or you start feeling the characteristic vibe of the inner prosecutor, the inner case maker, the rightness of your cause. And there's a place for rightness. There's a place, in my view, you know, for moral principle, standard, clarity, ethics, and so forth. But when it starts tipping into, a case making, drivenness is another quality. Superiority, that's such a good indicator. That little sense of being better than, or righter than, or more moral than, or greener than. Woo, bluer than, you know, the color schemes these days. That's a real giveaway too. And selfing, taking it personally, really getting caught up in that, feeling provoked or with a strong sense of ego involved or possessiveness or identification with one's own position. Those are all indicators. So with practice, we get better and better. And we start recognizing the suffering in craving. It's like clenching the rope of life that's continually the rope of time, the rope of life, sliding through our hands, or maybe we slide down it, either way. We start to notice what happens when we squeeze it more tightly and how it starts to hurt. And we naturally loosen our grip increasingly through increasing insight in real time, freed from longing through insight. In real time. Okay? So that's one. Tracking that movement. And then, as much as possible, getting back to safe ground. Loosening the grip, taking your breath, seeing really if we're winning battles but losing a war, seeing if there might be lighter, softer, gentler, less combative, less righteous, less critical, less scornful, less egotistical ways to accomplish the same wholesome end. Okay? That's the first suggestion. Second suggestion is to really take it in again and again and again, the felt sense of fullness and balance, the felt sense of needs met. So there's less and less of that predisposition towards something missing, something wrong. That's the biological basis for states of craving. Craving's a drive state, if you think about it through the lens of biology, including the biology of social mammals. We're big, sophisticated social mammals, highly social mammals. And if we repeatedly internalize the feeling of that's authentic, of things are basically okay, there's an enoughness, there's an all rightness, then we're less likely to get our knickers in a twist. Right? We're less likely to tip into frustration or fear or feelings of inadequacy or aggressiveness. Because we're calmer. We feel full already. You know, the issue is landing in a sense of feeling resourced already. And so that's my stuff on taking the good, repeatedly registering wholesome, ordinary, beneficial experiences so that you turn the state of the experience increasingly into a trait. State gratitude becomes trait gratitude. State compassion becomes trait compassion. State feelings, feeling cared about, feeling good with others, feeling connected, increasingly becomes trait confidence, trait secure attachment, trait feeling loved. Again and again and again. And as we do that, as we cultivate that increasingly stable core of resilient happiness inside, the essence of well-being. As we cultivate that increasingly, then when the waves of life ripple through us, we've got a super deep keel in the water and we're less rattled by them and we recover more quickly. If I'd honestly had, this was 21 years ago about, if I'd honestly had then a deeper feeling of inclusion, which was an issue for me as a kid. What happened to Forrest triggered me around my own material about being left out and, cast aside and, devalued. If I'd had more of a, at that stage, what I have more now, but if I had then more of a sense of inclusion and all rightness and easygoingness and feeling cared about and a few other good things, patience, one of those as well, a little more humility and modesty. But anyway, if I'd had more of those things, I could have handled the waves of what happened there. Things will happen. Waves will hit us. But what do they land on? Are we like a sailboat with no keel? I've capsized one, and I ended in Tamales Bay, realizing that I actually should have buckled my life jacket before I fell in the ocean. There's a few lessons there. But anyway, or when the waves of life hit us, do they hit us with a much deeper keel in the water in an embodied way, in our own body, through taking it in? That's the second suggestion. We can fill up our bank along the way for when the storms inevitably come. Okay, last one, kind of deep end of the pool. It's an ongoing process, I think, for me and other, most until you're fully awakened, other people. It's to find the stillness in the midst of all the changes. What I mean by that, what are those words toward the end? Freed from longing through insight, the wise one's mind is as still as a mountain pool. How can we be still while engaging life? While raising children, making love, making dinner, living, what are we talking about here? And there are a couple of clues about it. It's interesting, fundamental tension, if you will, or paradox as well, again in Buddhism, is between impermanence and that which doesn't change, the eventless, the unconditioned, the deathless. What is that? So one way into the sense of growing stillness amidst the changes is the sense of the stability of the field of awareness through which changing experiences arise, in which changing experiences arise and pass away. And in meditation or in the flow of everyday life, there can be the recognition of kind of like looking over your shoulder real fast before it disappears. The recognition of awareness as an untroubled field or space. The space between thoughts. There's still awareness in that space between thoughts and sensations. And as soon as you think about awareness, that thought is a content represented by it, right? So it's a little bit like you just kind of look with instant replay the last half second, half a minute or so, and you go, oh. And again and again and again, it's a registration of that effective stillness because it's an attainment of the stability of the person. That's one opportunity. Another opportunity to register what is effectively still is to again and again and again kind of register or come into a sense of the kind of allness of reality. Not getting cosmic about it. Clearly you look out at, wow, there's all this stuff. And through extension out into the universe, 2 trillion galaxies, you know, all this. And sure, you could subdivide it, but any kind of subdivision is pretty arbitrary. It's kind of wild to appreciate that pretty much all the atoms in your body and mine are exchanged, are new, roughly within every 7 years or so. Even the bones of the skull, all the little atoms, the bones of the skull gradually metabolize and exchange, you know, over, you know, 5-10 years. Isn't that remarkable? Just to think about us, we ourselves are like all, we're all standing waves, which is to say we're all simply patternings of a river. One river, river of reality, just patternings of it. Even the processes of mind, of thought, of inner language, just patternings locally of culture, human culture altogether, right? And so you start to increasingly get a sense of, wow, waves change with the ocean body. Local patterning, but life altogether, reality altogether, almost altogether, the material universe altogether doesn't change as the wind. And so you start to kind of get, oh, locally there's some change, but it's changing in something that isn't changing. Allness. Everything is. Maybe that starts intellectual, but I think there are lots of experiences. We go out into nature, for example. That's a common place where you feel like, whoa, it's like there's one biosphere in which there's change, right? But there's just one biosphere, in a sense. Even if the biosphere, its aspects change, biosphere is biosphere, has continuity. In a sense, you can feel that. You're in the forest, you go, wow, you know? Yeah, I'm like as a client of mine once said, a large male mammal about himself, and he has that feeling, and yet you just like, there's a whole that's primary, and the part is secondary. Okay. So that is another way into the sense of stillness. And the last thing I'll just say as a way into stillness, and it comes to my mind, someone in my life is really dealing with some struggles right now. And I have a lot of compassion for this person. And that compassion can fairly easily tip into problematic drivenness, fixing, solving, advising, directing, you know, whirlwind of, we're going to get this done. I've got my checklist and my yellow pad, and we're going to get it right. And there's good parts of that, but it can go too far, right? When I drop into the feeling of the permanence of the history, all the good in our relationship that's ever been will never not have been. It will always have been, right? The relatedness in our current time and the ways we're part of larger webs of relatedness, that too won't change. What's happening locally is real. There's no dismissing of it. There's no positive thinking here. There's no trying to, you know, make it go away. But what's problematic or painful or the suffering or the worry, the health issues that are coming around the bend, are experienced as a patterning, certainly, of reality, amidst countless other patternings of reality. And it make knowing that there's still great compassion and in desire and commitment to be helpful, but it's a lot easier to bear. And it's a lot easier to stay wise and not tip into the red zone, not tip into craving about it, when this patterning that is my friend's health issue is experienced and known amidst so much else that has continuity. Okay. All right, anyway. So just finish up here with, if you will, an image for yourself to imagine what it would be like to deal with a significant issue in your life, interpersonal issue, in which you feel it, you fully feel it, while also releasing pressure, insistence, demand, tension, mustness, releasing that, and having some refuge, taking some refuge in what feels stable or still in the sense of tranquil or quiet underneath it all or as the container of it all. All right. How about, what do you think? Questions or comments? Yeah.
I love those three strategies, and one that keeps coming up for me as I listen is, I think a lot of times we go into the craving and into the strategies because there's something uncomfortable about what is. And
right.
We're trying to get away from it or prevent it from happening or protect ourselves from feeling it.
Yeah.
So I think about growing my container of capacity to be with the uncomfortable, hard to handle feelings that are part of life, like grief and helplessness and powerlessness and rejection or whatever it is. Like if as I grow my capacity to be with that, then if the wave hits me less.
Right. Yeah, thank you very much. That's great. Yeah, I fully endorse that. Other comments, questions?
I was too busy typing and I forgot what's the difference between the second and the third.
Oh, in my suggestions?
Yeah.
So the second one was this idea of repeatedly internalizing experiences of resources, of needs met. You're safe, you're satisfied, you're connected. The three great needs that are umbrellas for almost everything we really care about. Okay, so you repeatedly do that. And then the third suggestion is harder to talk about. It's more of an experience. It's to find what is stably all right, that's always already all right, underneath or around, or as the fundamental nature of that which is not all right, that which is disturbing or problematic or an issue.
Could I say
that? Yeah, please.
The third one is also give you a perspective.
Great.
Because in a way that, I mean, before I know your thing,
when I
was in trouble or stressed out about certain things, what I do is I just go to Carl Sagan's The Little Blue Dots.
Yeah.
And he had this very famous, beautifully framed perspective of when you look at these tiny little blue dots in the universe, the Earth, how many people fight for the power, for the whatever, you know, social status, whatever. In the end, it's just a blue little dot.
Yes. So that's beautiful. Yeah. Did you want to say more on that?
Then I kind of reflected on what happened to me today, actually. Recently, there was a news about this Chinese doctor, a Vietnamese Chinese doctor, refused to get out of the United Airlines.
Yeah.
And I, before I know it, was mega big argument on my Facebook friends. actually, it's not even argument. It's unilaterally like blaming and like really like blaming on United Airlines.
Okay.
And it's all Chinese, and they are all actually a group of Buddhists, you know. And this monk put it first, original article is about kind of you can still learn something about the rules of the airline and blah, blah, blah. I mean, in the end, it's coming out the answer of the rule or regulations of the airline. And then, but then he added a second article, which is a Chinese wrote it like, this is a racial discrimination, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. I'm like, there are four passengers. They're randomly signed. You know, they first pay you to get out, and then they ask you to get out, and finally you don't get out, and then they take you out. I mean, what's wrong with this? And you know, and there are.
I could think of something, but keep going.
I was just thinking that with all the other three passengers, they get out with no problem because it's randomly signed. You know, why you don't respect the rule and the regulation and you still do not want to go?
Yeah.
And anyway, so I was saying that there is another way to look at this situation.
Okay.
But then I was like, ooh, all these people just.
Yeah, I know.
And I would just feel like, and then they started to, arguing about the money, and they say, oh, they should increase the price. So I said, so you take it as advantage of making more money out of this? Is it the fight of the power and the money in the end?
Right. And meanwhile, this little blue dot, right, is going around the sun. I have this little picture in my on my screensaver. It's a NASA picture. It's from the Voyager little orbiter satellite thingy they sent out, a long time ago. Carl Sagan was quite involved with that. And it's gone past the solar system, and it's the picture is the very farthest picture of Earth, taken from out probably past Pluto or close to it. And you can see there's this little tiny white dot that is Earth in this midst of a bunch of other things. You can just barely pick out that particular dot. It's a picture of us from as far away as any, human imagery has come. And it really does put it in perspective, doesn't it? Yeah. Well, I'm going to move toward an end soon here. Tom, did you want to finish up?
Yeah. I just wanted to say, one of the things that really came to mind, in fact, I practiced it today, is to call on a trusted friend, partner, since we're talking about relationships, and to divulge, confess of what's going on with you. And for me, that brings a greater perspective. It brings support. And I found that very beneficial. It's not something I am typically drawn to.
Yeah.
And I hold things in. Mm. And the second thing that came to mind was with your son is the opportunity to create celebration in our lives for situations. And that might have been an opportunity upon reflection. Who knows? But
oh, yeah.
Great story.
Oh, yeah. Well, I lost perspective. I didn't think about the blue dot, as it were. Okay, for sure, brief, and then we'll wrap her up.
I have to say that I was just very calm and everything until you started talking about this Pinewood Derby. And it just totally brought me back to a very similar situation. The question that runs in my mind is, what's the alternative? Like, what would you have been?
Great.
You have done? What would you have said to your son? There's nothing that triggers me more than somebody doing something bad to my kid.
Yeah, for sure.
And I would have been there. I mean, I would have been pulling somebody's hair out or something. I would have been really, totally distraught.
Yeah,
So the idea of backing up from that, but it's like unfair. It's unfair. It's not
right. It's great. So if using those three points, just maybe this is a good recap. One, I would have been so much more mindful and self-aware of my own intensity and drivenness and hijacking and the ways I was also turbocharged and my views were distorted and turbocharged by the transference into the present time of my own, and projection onto my son, using that lingo, of my own material as a dorky kid who never won anything, you know, let alone a Pinewood Derby. So I would have been much more aware of the movement into craving, you know, in real time, or much more rapidly retrospective, shorter cycle time. That's the first thing. Second thing, I would have felt already a lot more resourced. Like there's ongoingness here. I could have taken in a lot more experiences of reassurance related to our son. Things are okay. It's working. It's unfolding. You know, this troop is good. You know, it'll be all right. You know, things like that. I could have taken that in a lot better, I think, along the way. And then the last thing, I would have been, if I could, with hindsight, you know, I could have seen that I was going to war with this particular wave that had rolled through our son's life and our family's life. And it's this transient, impermanent phenomenon. And if I could have recognized that, this is just an event. This is something that we will forget about soon. I need to put it in perspective. And the fundamental continuity of goodness in our family wasn't going to be touched, you know, and like a deeper sense of the eternal, the timeless, in which this particular wave was moving forward through time, I think that too would have helped me be more judicious, I think there's a place for gravity, but with a certain dignity and not losing it. I kind of lost it a little bit, you know, in my very well-educated kind of way, which is some of the worst forms of losing it. You know, anyway, so, okay, see for yourself, all right? Freed from longing, the wise one, freed from longing through insight, with a mind as peaceful and untroubled as a mountain pond. How about we sit with that for a minute and finish up? If I may, just to underline something I wish I'd said a little more clearly, awareness is a space through which things move, but which itself doesn't move. And there can be a sense of that as well, that allness, the ocean of allness itself doesn't change. And even there can be a sense of the unconditioned or the eternal always just prior to the next moment that itself doesn't change. Anyway, however it is that you experience stillness or stability or a fundamental stability of all rightness, register those experiences. Take in that good as well. Let those land as well. So increasingly, you're stabilized in stillness even as you engage this world of wonders. Well, take care. See you next week. And our son turned out really well.